For more information on Ancient Dragon Zen Gate, please visit our website at www.ancientdragon.org. Our teachings are offered to the community through the generosity of our supporters. To make a donation online, please visit our website.
Good evening, everyone.
Good evening.
It's good to see so many of you here, familiar faces. So in the word to Judy Rutschman Weiler, I'm not afraid of you guys. I asked to chant the Guidepost for Silent Illumination tonight because it really is the sort of jewel poem of Hongzhi Zhenjue and the entire movement of Zhaodong teaching of enlightenment and practice that grew up, well, it had been around for a long time within the Zhaodong school. It became particularly influential during the 12th century with the when there was a revival of the Zhaodong school, which had gotten pretty moribund. An interesting thing about the name, Guidepost for Silent Illumination, is that silent illumination is really evocative and it expresses the nature of the teaching very well. But it's a term that Hongzhi himself used, I think, only a couple of times. And for the most part, nobody else in the Zhaodong school before him used that term. It was used mostly by opponents of Zhaodong, it was kind of a derisive term for them, for the Linxi people who, thought that had a different approach to awakening, that you would practice intensively and strive very hard and to have a moment of awakening in time. And that's not what the Zhaodong teaching was, and not what the silent illumination teaching was. And so it's created sort of a conflict. The basic teaching and a view of enlightenment and practice that Hongzhi and his predecessors had is that we are originally awakened. We are inherently and always awake, that there is an undefiled awareness, an awareness at all times that is not caught up in dualistic thoughts or emotions or desires. And we're not aware of that because we are caught up in those dualistic thoughts, emotions, and desires. But that if we can sit down in non-dualistic meditation, at that moment, we can realize and verify our inherent awakening, our inherent Buddha nature. So the question is sort of, okay, well, what is non-dualistic meditation? And, that's sort of the calling card of the Zhaodong school. It's that, if our problem is that our mind fixes on objects of attention and we reify them, fixed independent things, then we have project all sorts of desires and thoughts and evaluations and emotions on it. Then we need to stop doing that. We need to no longer be caught up in thinking, discursive thinking about, and feelings and desires and emotions about this and that, like this, like right, wrong, good, bad, should, shouldn't, and so on. So the question is how you do that, and that's the silent part of silent illumination. And underneath all of this these deluded mental operations is conceptual thinking, deluded conceptual thinking that grasps onto things, the objects of thought, as if they were real things. This is the projected reification that the objects of our awareness don't actually possess. And so we need to stop doing that. And so not doing that is the silence. And it's the serenity, because that kind of thinking and feeling and desire and judgment is what leads to the anxiety and frustration and suffering. It's the reason that we're here. But silence is not the only way that Zazen teachers have talked about that. Dealing with our deluded mental operations, they talk about stillness or darkness or non-thinking. You know, we think of Dogen in Fukan Zazengi, and I think it's fair to refer to Dogen because Shikantaza, his dropping off body and mind, and Fukan Zazengi is a teaching within this tradition of silent illumination. In fact, Fukan Zazengi is largely quotations taken from another meditation manual and includes a lot of other phrases that had existed within Zaodong meditation traditions for centuries by that time, about taking the backward step and shining the light within, and Zazen being the gate of joy and ease, the practice of joy and ease, and that when we let go of our deluded mental operations and judging and evaluating and analyzing and describing, our original face appears immediately. The original face being this reality. This reality as this reality without the delusion that we are somehow separate from the world and all of the other things are separate from each other. And that's fundamentally the teaching, that what we need to do is be still physically and also mentally. We no longer undertaking any form of conscious, deliberate activity, mental or physical. And when we do that, when we aren't caught up in conscious thinking anymore, and that isn't giving rise to this deluded sense of understanding of the world, then obviously thinking and feelings and emotions continue, and we let them go, but they don't have the same hold on us. That as soon as we sit without movement, and our mind ceases its deliberate activity, it's deliberate motion, then we have stepped back, taken the backward step, as Dogen and Zaodong teachers said, and we have reached a moment of freedom and liberation from that delusion. And having taken that backward step, having expressed that silence, then the world opens to us, and we find ourselves in this vast world of interrelationship, interactivity, interdependence, something that's not separate from us. It's an all-inclusive vision, and that vision is the illumination. And in not just in Hongzhi's poetry, but in other teachings as well, that vision is referred to in terms of light and radiance and brightness and so on. Zaodong teachers insisted so much on that stillness that they came up with practice to practice hints, practice instructions, in the same way that Hunter did. Hunter had some shorter ones as well, but some of the most common ones that are repeated by all the major Zhaozhong teachers, would say the 12th century, including Hunter, that you should sit like a dried up piece of wood. Or you should be like a cold incense burner in an abandoned temple. And I like that one because it gives the image of that silent stillness. Nothing is going on in the burning incense. It's not burning anymore, so the fire and heat of deluded passions is gone. Or sit like a strip of white silk, which doesn't resonate quite with me, but it was very popular. It gives me the idea of this, the flexibility of the silk cloth, the strip of silk cloth that isn't stained by attachment or aversion to illusion. And example of what our meditation should be is the wither tree in front of the hall gives forth spring flowers. So it's a combination of this withered, still thinking. It isn't the deluded thinking is in it, and from that the color and brightness of the illumination arises. And Hongzhi himself has one that's my favorite instruction of this sort. Hongzhi has is, in the great rest and great halting, the lips become moldy and mountains of grass grow on your tongue. Move straight ahead, totally let go, wash clean and ground to a fine polish. The same, so he evokes those same images of being so still, really perhaps even in a sense that the deluded mind has died in a sense, it's lost its life and power, so that the mold is growing on your lips and the grass is growing on your tongue, but you have entered this realm of light in which it has been highly polished, washed clean, ground to a fine polish. So these are themes and images that you see in Hongzhi's religious verses and in others of his practice instructions. And you see it in the guidepost for a silent illumination too. Before I get to the guidepost for silent illumination, I guess the question is, well, then what do we do? What is this kind of silent illumination sitting? And it really is not different from Shikan Taza. It really is stillness, just stillness, not doing and not intentionally thinking. So just taking your posture, being upright and still with your eyes half open, your breath regular and measured, and not doing anything else. You're not concentrating, you're not being mindful of anything in particular, you're not trying to understand anything in particular, you're not focusing on anything, so not undertaking any intentional activity at all, just thoughts come and go, non-thinking. You're not thinking, but thoughts are coming and going. And when that happens, we come back to this moment, just right here. Nothing different from this moment right here. It's not as if anything changes. We don't perceive anything that we haven't perceived before. It's been here all along. It's the inherent awakened mind. It's been here all along. It's not like all of the specifics of this body and these clothes and hair and eyes and so on disappear. Reality doesn't become like a bowl of milk when we wake up from delusion. The things are no longer, but We wake up to reality, the wholeness, the completeness of reality, in which everything has its specific place and everything is interacting. And so all we do is sit and allow ourselves to wake up, to allow this awakened awareness to simply emerge when we're no longer wrapped up in our deluded thinking and feelings and emotions, judgments. Inevitably, thoughts come and go, thoughts come and go. We don't try to suppress them, we don't try to control them, we don't try to observe them, we don't try to understand them. They're part of what's going on in the moment, along with our breathing, the sounds of the world, the smells of the incense, whatever is happening. And then we get grabbed, then we get distracted, we pursue the thoughts, emotions, and so on. But when we come back, all we do is check our posture, resume our sitting, and not doing anything, just in stillness. In fact, I think the most helpful meditation instruction for Shikantaza, silent illumination, that I've heard is just don't meditate. Just sit there. Don't daydream. Don't sink down. Just sit there. And when you realize that you've been caught up in doing something different, just resume, fix your posture, and continue sitting. So that's all the background I had. The guidepost for silent illumination contains these themes and provides some other, it both discusses, expresses what's involved in meditation, what's involved in waking up, mistakes that we can find, and what this awakened world, what this awakened life is like. So, for example, the first line of the poem is, silent and serene, forgetting words, bright clarity appears before you. And that's enough. That is the teaching. Is letting go of the thoughts, letting go of the conceptualization, letting go of the thoughts and feelings that underlie and the conceptualization that underlie all those things. We step free of that delusion and the world opens up in front of us. And there are other lines as well that emphasize that same approach. In darkness, it is most bright, while hidden, all the more manifest. Only silence is the supreme speech. Only illumination, the universal response. So emphasizing, and other examples too, that in that darkness, in that silence, in that non-thinking, in that no mind, in that stillness is the life of illumination and radiance and brightness, is our experience of this whole world. But he has a warning for us. But it's not that the stopping, the stillness, the stepping back from the deluded thinking is not separate, cannot be separated from the illumination, the opening. They come together, and it's not a matter of, for example, oh, I'm going to step back from the thinking, and then the radiant vision of the world arises. Those are two aspects of the same turn that our mind undertakes. They can't be separated. And so he addresses that how those are interfused, that the silence and the illumination are interfused, inseparable, interdependent, by noting that if illumination neglects serenity, then aggressiveness appears. factors. And I think aggressiveness is really talking about all of our reactiveness based on habit energy, based on karmic energy, so that when we stick and we're not, for example, all of the thinking that arises when we're not deliberately thinking is all habit energy, all reactivity. But if illumination neglects serenity, if we have the illumination, if we have the vision of this all-encompassing, all-inclusive world, and we grasp it, it becomes a perception that we're going to hold on to. We neglect the non-grasping of silence and stillness, then we just fall back into delusion again. So even this illumination can become an object of delusion. He says, certifying and dialoguing, the two respond to each other appropriately. And if serenity neglects illumination, murkiness leads to wasted dharma. So if we experience it through the letting go, letting go, letting go, letting our thoughts arise, expel their habit energy, their emotional charge, and disappear, we get caught up in that feeling of serenity, we grasp that serenity, and we lose the vision at the same time. It's only when silent illumination is fulfilled, when we have both the non-grasping silence and the illumination that we have, then that is when we verify and realize our inherent awakening. Only when silent illumination is fulfilled, the lotus blossoms and the dreamer awakens. When we awaken, then, hunger gives us the vision of what that is involved. The 10,000 forms majestically glisten and expound the Dharma. All objects certify it, everyone in dialogue. The teaching of silent illumination penetrates from the highest down to the foundation. From the beginning to end, the changing appearances and 10,000 differences share one pattern. So he tells us that illumination, he suggests that it has, in a way, it has two aspects that we would never describe during our meditation, of the different aspects. One is the aspect of wholeness and completeness of reality, and then the experience of every individual thing having its place, its ultimate, absolute place in the world, but its place is in interaction and dialogue and certification with everything else. So that is the vision then of, that is the experience of, in short, the poem is talking about what's involved in meditation. And when we open is through sitting in meditation, what is that experience? What is the experience? So I'm going to leave this here now and see if anyone has any thoughts or comments. Thank you. I agree. This is so simple that there's no need for commentary.
I have a question.
Dylan, please.
I'm remembering that the supposed opponent of Hongzhe at that time, from the rival school, that the two of them were actually close friends, and that they had different styles, but that they had an interesting dharmic relationship, but I don't remember his name or their name.
Kawai?
So I would love to hear a little bit about them, from whoever knows something about their relationship, and how they supported each other or were destabilized by each other, I guess.
I think it's kind of hard to reconstruct the relationship after 9 centuries. But, you know, Dawe, Dawe's teaching was based on the same fundamental teaching of inherent, of original awakening and inherent enlightenment that the Zadong teaching was. But his view was that you needed to practice and strive very hard in order to have this moment of awakening in time to recognize and realize that inherent enlightened nature. And the Zaodong teaching, Silent Illumination, in Shikan Taza says, well, that's really not necessary. That we open to reality, we experience the world in our life in an awakened manner all the time. We simply have to give that awakened mind the opportunity to emerge, and it does that through meditation. Dawe was one of the people who used the term silent illumination sort of as a sneer. He would talk about how these Zadong monks practicing their silent illumination are sitting in silent caves of delusion, dark caves of delusion. So the one reason I say it's difficult to reconstruct the relationship is that Hongzhi did say that at his death, he would like for Dawe to take over his affairs, manage his affairs after his death. And Dawe, certainly, there's some writings in which Dawe talks about what a great Zen teacher Hongzhi was, but he also gets some little digs in as well. So sometimes you have to wonder if he was, you know, damning with faint praise. So it's hard to say, but those are differences in the views of awakening and the nature of practice that have persisted, you know, in Japan between the Rinzai school and the Soto school. I have to ask, you know, how firm those positions really were in real life. Zadong teachers also sometimes allowed students to work with koans. I'm confident that all these Zadong monks were also having awakening experiences. And I'm confident that Vinci and Rinzai practitioners have always found awakening in sitting as well, in that natural unfolding of awakening in practice, even separate from that boom experience, that explosive experience in time. So it's hard to know. But, and, you know, there's plenty that's been written about what was behind the vehemence there. People didn't seem to say, well, maybe there's a little of both. These are two different expressions of inherent awakening that we can all find in our practice. And part of it, there's a pretty good suggestion that part of it was competition for high-level government officials who were lay followers and who had a lot of influence in raising money and raising support from the government. And saying, well, those guys are idiots, this is what the real view is one way to say, so your money ought to come to my monastery rather than their monastery. Maybe that's on the margins. I'm sure that these people felt pretty sincerely about their positions.
Yeah, it kind of reminds me of like Zen Larry Bird and Magic Johnson or something, or like two folks kind of, you know, through different approaches to what they're doing, like kind of making it like lifting, like through not competitiveness directly, but through pushing each other, like dharmically maybe, it was moving model practice forward in some way, right? There being two great schools at the same time.
Yeah. But I think that if you read Dawei's letters, he wrote a lot of letters to lay disciples, the students of his. You just keep nodding your head, yeah. So we find a lot of value in his writing as well. David.
Thank you, Douglas. I wonder if I could ask you about the series of poetic images, starting at the fifth line, dew in the moonlight, a river of stars, snow-covered pines, clouds enveloping the peak. So they're really beautiful, and they sound to me like they're a series of attempts to point, all to point at the same thing. And do you have thoughts about what that is? Are those like those monochrome images like snow in a silver bowl, or are they something different?
Yeah, that's kind of how I see it. Is you've got the darkness of night and the sunlight, having the moonlight reflecting in all these on these tips of grass tips that have drops of dew, so that there are sparkles of light in the darkness and this field of sparkling light, or the river of stars in the sky. This vast expanse of beings together, interrelated, and the snow-covered pines on the cloudy mountain peak, the site of the identifiable pines emerging from this vast snowy expanse of universality. That's not the word I like, but something like that.
I think, and Taigen might comment on this, but I think these are also not just exclusive to Zen, but are Chinese poetic imagery from other Chinese poetic schools, which you probably know much better in the original. But I think that they point to something, but they're also using cultural things that are familiar to the literati class. And I think, what are those images for us? You know, what are these, what are images that are alive for us in our culture? And how does this silent illumination work in this world of, that we live in, of, you know, multimedia and, deep mind AI, you know, and so how is this going to be alive now for us? Because to me, like the, you know, moldy tongue and all that, like I don't relate to that as a 21st century American woman, you know, and I wonder how this is going to manifest for us. They're very beautiful, but we have to find our own images, I think.
Yeah, people like Hunger had to be able to communicate with that literati class of people who had wielded so much influence on their behalf. And so they had all of these people at the great public monasteries, the huge ones, the great Zen teachers, to be named as head of one of the public monasteries that had thousands of monks, who was receiving enormous amounts of government largesse and constantly seeking to raise money for the bureaucracy and the emperor and the local government. These people had to have the same education in order to be able to talk to people who could give them money. And to attract they had to be able to attract their attention. And so they had, these are people who had classical literary educations and they knew their Confucianism particularly well, as well as having tremendous educations in classical Buddhist literature. That's why when we read so much Zen literature, all of these great Zen masters who were also heads of these enormous monasteries are making these references to Buddhist scripture all the time, or to other literature.
So it also reminds me of the New York Review of each other's books. You know, that there's this class that are all friends, and they're all went to the same schools, and on the person in the street, you know, if you read about like material culture at this time in China, you know, people, the average illiterati like myself, you know, were running around very devoted, you know, and their voices maybe aren't heard at times. So I find this really beautiful, but I think about the people who are just taking care of these grounds in the monastery, who are reciting dharanis or have charms and talismans, praying for the well-being in this really tumultuous time. So it's such an interesting, rich, you know, we hear and have one sort of set of literature, but I think that there's more discoveries happening as people do unpack some of these. You know, this coming this Sunday, we're going to be visited by Stefan Leica, a professor at U of C who kind of studies Buddhist stuff, and his class. And it'll be interesting. I've just read just some tiny writings by him, but it's, I think we'll be illuminated. This will be another kind of illumination, illuminating some of the darkness that hasn't been seen, you know, because of hegemony of a certain group of people. And so I think our great task in some ways is to take that hegemony and kind of turn it on its head or incorporate it to what we're awakened together. You know, so it's very exciting. You know, I think to know this, it's so beautiful, but it's also like adding, I don't know, Toni Morrison to Shakespeare or something, you know, that we have our work to do.
Yeah, I think there's, and it sometimes, I have to wish that we had access to so much of the academic work that's in Japanese and Chinese to understand more. But as you were saying, the people who weren't these elite monks spending time in the meditation hall and doing all this studying were certainly had, both workers and people outside the monasteries had great devotion and were trying to express compassion and kindness in their lives, but also to obtain a good rebirth, more hope, and valued the monasteries because the monasteries could perform funerals for good rebirths, and they could also bring rain and soothe wrathful divinities that might cause problems for the community and things like that. And that's what they really cared about, that monasteries were engines of merit that they could dedicate to the benefit of the rest of the world.
So I wonder if people, that's what we're seeking in some ways, that same kind of magical healing. You know, that by sitting together, we could take care of our world, our earth. We have this wonderful earth behind Buddha. Liberate people from situation.
That was my kind of knee-jerk reaction when, Douglas, you were talking about the metaphor of the cold incense burner in an abandoned temple. I was like, that just struck me as horrible. How do we bring life?
The point is that he's just saying you have to calm, you have to step back from the thinking, and it opens up to the radiance. As soon as you do that, then you see the radiance of the world.
Okay.
Yeah.
Douglas tightens patiently, holding his hand up. Just wanted to let you know.
Yeah.
Thank you, Douglas. Just briefly to one of Hogetsu's points, some of these images do have specific meanings. For example, the River of Stars is what we call the Milky Way. That's how they designated it. But yeah, to Hogetsu's points, or one of her points, it would be interesting to rewrite the guidepost for silent illumination using, modern images, or, you know, even nature images that we relate to. So that's a challenge for us.
How about this? All electronics unplugged. No No sound from Alexa, you know, or something, you know, like there's
ain't it foggy outside, all the planes have been grounded.
Yeah, right. Silence. You know, or how do you be still in the midst of terror and destruction and oppression? And how do you meet someone on the street who's homeless or unhoused, let's say? You know, so there's life, a lot of life here, and it's so beautiful. Like, you know, when I read this, I feel like, yeah, I'm like this, you know, Song Dynasty rock star or something, you know, sitting. But then I think, well, what about us today? You know, when I take off these robes and do whatever I do, you know.
Well, I think that sort of the demythification of what we do is something that is just underway. I mean, it's been going on in Christianity for quite a long time, but you have to ask yourself, we perform a service. We dedicate merit to the entire world, also to dead people. And you have to ask, well, what does that really mean to me? What does that mean to me? Because I'm not going to take that literally. So I certainly believe that our practice can lead to benefit for all beings, but it's not, I've created merit that I can enter into somebody else's merit ledger so that they have a good rebirth or awaken more quickly. And I think, so we need to, at some point we, as American Buddhists or modern Buddhists, wherever in the world, we're going to have to work with that.
And the proof is in the pudding. So it's how we treat each other, how we treat the people we love and the people we don't love, and how we approach when our feet touch the ground or when our butts hit the cushion. You know, all of that awareness is probably no different than what Silent Illumination is talking about, or what Rinzai people are talking about, or what Theravadan people are talking about. But we find it in our expression. So it's a wonderful opening of this, Douglas. Thank you.
Thank you. Where are we on time?
I was going to say,
we're ready to roll. Yeah.
Okay. Well, then we should have the four bodhisattva vows.
And then announcements.
And then announcements.
Okay.
These are numbers. We vow to free them. Delusions are inexhaustible. We vow to cut through them. Dharma gates are boundless. We vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. We vow to realize it. Beings are numberless. We vow to free them. Delusions are inexhaustible. We vow to cut through them. Dharma gates are boundless. We vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. We vow to realize it. Beings are numberless. We vow to free them. Delusions are inexhaustible. We vow to cut through them. Dharma gates are boundless. We vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. We vow to realize it.